This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Two British militants believed to be part of an Islamic State group are now in American custody. AP correspondent Mike Rossia.
British militants El Shafi El Sheikh and Alexander Emankute have been transferred from a detention center in Syria into American custody, according to U.S. officials. The preemptive move was made because of security concerns stemming from Turkey's offensive against Kurdish fighters in northern Syria. Surviving captives nicknamed El Sheikh Emankute and other British jihadis the Beatles because of their British accents. In 2014, and 2015, the two allegedly were part of a group that beheaded seven American, British, and Japanese journalists and aid workers and a group of Syrian soldiers in videos released to the world. Mike Gracia, Washington.
U.S. President Donald Trump predicts that his impeachment battle with House Democrats will wind up before the U.S. Supreme Court. The president spoke to reporters Wednesday, a day after the White House says that it is refusing to participate in the Democratic-led inquiry into whether he should be impeached. Mr. Trump did not say exactly what House leaders must do if they want his cooperation, but he said he would cooperate if they give us our rights and Republicans get a fair shake. Meanwhile, former Vice President Joe Biden and current Democratic presidential frontrunner, for the first time, joined the call by House Democrats to impeach Mr. Trump.
We all laughed when he said he could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot someone and get away with it. It's no joke. He's shooting holes in the Constitution, and we cannot let him get away with it.
Trump replied by saying that Biden is falling like a rock. I don't think he's going to make it, the president said in an apparent reference to Biden's recent slippage in the polls. He's accused of Biden of corruption, alleging that when he was vice president, he threatened to withhold loan guarantees to Ukraine. And yet, unless the government stops investigating a gas company for which Biden's son Hunter held a seat. This is VOA News. Federal prosecutors in Germany have assumed control of an investigation into the shooting deaths of two people in the city of Halle. The country's federal prosecutors handle cases involving possible terrorism and national security. The shootings occurred Wednesday near a synagogue and a Turkish kebab restaurant. A heavily armed man tried to enter the synagogue as about 80 people were inside observing Yom Kippur, one of the holiest days of the Jewish calendar. When he was unable to get inside, he shot a woman on the street and then another person inside the kebab shop. At one point, California power company Pacific Gas and Electric says that it was going to shut off power to as many as 2 million customers as the company's way of reducing the possibility of sparks causing devastating wildfires in a region that is particularly prone during the current dry season. The move affects 34 counties in California, and PG&E executive Sumeet Singh says that the utility has been able to restore power to a limited number of customers.
In the interest of public safety to minimize the impact and disruption to our customers, we have identified limited areas where we could safely energize sections by reconfiguring our electrical system.
California has had a history of wildfires that cost billions of dollars in damages, rebuilding and insurance claims, and, of course, the loss of life. Last year's Camp Fire was the biggest and deadliest wildfire in California's history, destroying more than 18,000, nearly 19,000 structures and killing 86 people. On the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection list of California's most destructive wildfires, 8 of those 20 infernos are just from the past 2 years. The price of electricity jumped an alarming 320% in Zimbabwe Wednesday as the country continues to spiral into the worst economic crisis in more than a decade. The Zimbabwe Energy Regulatory Authority said it had approved the request by the National Power Company to increase the rate from 38 Zimbabwe cents per kilowatt hour to 162 Zimbabwe cents. The price hike was the second in 3 months. In August, ZERA approved the price hike of 400%. Authorities said the hike was needed for the power company to be able to afford to maintain its equipment and buy fuel for its generators. More at VOAnews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
America. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, October the 10th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Zimbabwe's government raises the cost of electricity by about 300% amid soaring inflation.
Importing electricity from South Africa in Mozambique, and because of the cost of importing electricity, the government has no other way but to raise the cost of electricity to the consumers.
Frank Guni is the chair of ZANU-PF USAID East Coast Branch. Hundreds of Kenyan youth protested Wednesday over the lack of employment. Rwandan authorities questioned Victoire Ingabire for possible involvement in last week's attack. Zambia's president says over 300 opposition members defect to the ruling party in Kaoma Chitwa. And Ugandan police blocked Bobby Wine Wednesday from holding yet another scheduled concert.
He fulfilled almost everything, but he left out three key components, which are, one, the medical care plan, two, the traffic control plan, three, firefighting equipment plan.
Patrick Oyango is the deputy police spokesperson. African women are working to close the digital divide, and the WHO says 22 million people in sub-Saharan Africa suffer from blindness. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Zimbabwean government Wednesday raised the cost of electricity by over 300% amid soaring inflation. This was the second increase in 3 months. The Zimbabwe Energy Regulatory Authority said the price hike is necessary to compensate for the nearly 300% rise in inflation. Frank Guni is the chairman of the ruling ZANU-PF branch on the east coast of the United States. He says Zimbabwe imports electricity from South Africa and Mozambique, and because of the high cost of importing electricity, the government had no alternative but to raise the cost of electricity.
We have a problem of electricity in Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe is not able to generate adequate electricity. We are generating power from our hydro sources at below the minimums that we require. So we are importing electricity from South Africa and Mozambique. And because of the import tariffs and the cost of importing electricity, the government has no other way but to raise the cost of using electricity to the consumers. We are also encouraging Zimbabweans to find other alternatives of generating energy. For example, we have liberalized the importation of solar panels and solar kits so that Zimbabweans can use environmentally friendly energy sources like solar energy.
But this is coming in the midst of really, really tough economic conditions in Zimbabwe. So my question is, the ordinary people, can they afford this?
Not necessarily. We are aware that the cost of not just electricity, cost of bread, cost of water, cost of everything in Zimbabwe is very high because of the macroeconomic fundamentals. People have to understand that right now, Zimbabwe is in a financial transitional process. The first step that we have taken as the new government is to ensure that there is austerity. We arrest government spending and we make sure that people and the government live within their means. If you go to Zimbabwe today, everything is imported. People are importing unnecessary things. So, for example, people are importing matches. People are importing salt from South Africa and Botswana. But we make those things in Zimbabwe. And our economy will not grow as long as we are buying everything from someone else. We need to start empowering our own industries to produce goods and services that can be utilized in Zimbabwe. And then we start exporting. Once we start exporting, then we increase foreign currency inflows. That will stabilize the macroeconomic fundamentals of the nation. If we don't do that, we'll continue in a cycle of problems.
Of course, the elephant hanging over all this is the political impasse. I think it was just last week that a blessing in Harare spoke to Nelson Chamisa after the president had given a speech to the nation. Chamisa is saying that the president did not get it right because he should have started with the political impasse in the country.
As far as we are concerned, there's no political impasse. ZANU-PF won the elections. Our president is the legitimate president of Zimbabwe. We have a majority in parliament that was elected by the people of Zimbabwe. Chamisa, just like any other political leader, is welcome to join the national dialogue. The president of Zimbabwe, President Emmerson Mnangagwa, and our party, ZANU-PF, have created a political actors dialogue forum, which is called POLAD. All political parties that participated in the elections are welcome. All the other 21 political parties have joined except for Chamisa and his party. We have now included the churches. We have now included the business sector. And the idea is that as Zimbabweans, let's come together and create solutions for our national problems. If Chamisa thinks that he is so special that he cannot join with everyone else, then he is lost. He can stay there. Chamisa is not the panacea to Zimbabwean's problems. Zimbabwe has numerous problems, we do admit that. That's why we are calling on him and all other Zimbabweans to come together so that we have homegrown solutions to our national problems.
Frank Guni is the chair of the ZANU-PF branch on the east coast of the United States. He spoke with us in our Washington studio. As Uganda marked its 57th Independence Day yesterday, Wednesday, parliamentarian Robert Chakulayi, popularly known as Bobby Wine, woke up to the reality that he is not free to hold concerts in Uganda. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
Robert Chagulanyi, whose stage name is Bobby Wine, found police heavily deployed around his home and One Love Beach on the outskirts of Kampala. The musician turned politician was meant to hold a concert to release his latest song, It's Possible. But police say they carried out preventive arrest measures to ensure Wine doesn't hold the concert. Uganda Police Deputy Spokesman Patrick Onyango says Wine was informed he hadn't made adequate preparations for the performance.
He fulfilled almost everything, but he left out three key components, which are, one, the medical care plan, two, the traffic control plan, three, firefighting equipment plan, and crowd control.
In the past weeks, President Yoweri Museveni has not only endorsed concerts held by musicians who support him, but also attended the concerts. In a Facebook post, Wine said this is his 156th concert that has been blocked by the government. He urged Museveni to compete fairly when it comes to music. Joel Senyonyi, spokesperson of the People Power Resistance Movement led by Wine, sees a political motivation for the cancelled performance.
With President Museveni, who is very fearful of People Power because the wave has come to sweep him. And so he's extremely afraid and he will keep pressing the panic buttons.
A few of Wine's supporters battled police in the city center. Wine eluded security forces and was reportedly riding a motorcycle to rally his supporters, who police had dispersed with tear gas. Senyonyi was asked to describe the song Wine intended to release.
It is possible that we can rise up from the doldrums in which we are. It is possible that we can see a smooth transition of power. It is possible that we can see a betterment of our country in terms of governance, but even at an individual level, that you're grappling with many different things, that it is possible for you to rise again.
The police insist their actions are not political and that Wine must fulfill concert guidelines before he is allowed to hold a concert. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
Hundreds of Kenya youth protested Wednesday over the lack of employment. Many companies have been laying off workers, citing economic hardship, as the unemployment rate tops 72%, with majority of the unemployed being young people. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi.
The youths were chanting all the way from Freedom Corner before their march was interrupted by the police. Speaking during the march, a jobless youth who was fired a few weeks ago, Julia Awor, said that most companies are struggling financially and now opting to fire employees, as unemployment rate at 75% in Kenya and youth alone leading with 40%.
We need the president to come out and answer our questions. They need to realize us as the youth are suffering. It is so wrong and it is so sad. So we need to stand up as Kenyans and be united. Comrade Power!
Power!
Comrade Power!
Power!
Viva!
Viva!
According to the survey by the Kenya National Bureau of Statistics in 2018, 7 million Kenyans were unemployed, with 1.4 million out of this figure desperately looking for jobs. Triza Mikata had just worked for 4 years after completing her studies at Higher Learning, lost her job, and now struggling to earn a living She narrates her ordeal.
And I got a job which was not good, and this year I came to get a good job, and being a single mom, having two kids, it was nice for me, but on 27th of September, my dream was shut down, whereby the company gave us a letter that after this month we'll be terminated, so we are wondering, where are we going as Kenyans, you know?
The last 1 week, at least 1,200 Kenyans lost jobs when the betting company's spokesperson Betin withdrew their services in Kenya. Julius Kimani, a youth who has ventured in business, says the economy is not friendly since his business is also struggling.
I am not even an employee. That is one. But I know that the economy of Kenya is dead. It is the doldrums, because I'm a businessman. And I think the first person who feels the pinch when the economy is not doing well is a businessman. Today you can go for maybe 3 days or even a week without making any sales. But I know one thing, that what has killed the economy of Kenya is corruption.
Leading the demonstrations, activist Waithera Wanjiku said that corruption is the main cause of the rate of economic bad times affecting businesses that are leading to youth unemployment.
The major rate of unemployment has been caused by three things: politicization of unemployment and the population. So, but there is a huge fraction of the people that are this vulnerable, and the politicians know that it's us they will come to by the end of the day and will legitimize their government. The other issue is a bad economy because of corruption, because of exploitation, because of all these things.
The government of Kenya is still struggling to create employment for the young people, as the current government had promised the youth at least 3.7 million jobs, which has never been achieved. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, October the 10th. Daybreak Africa time is now 16 and a half minutes past the hour. Rwanda's Investigation Bureau on Wednesday summoned Victoire Ingabire, leader of the FDU Inkingi political party, for her possible involvement in last week's attack on a tourist center, killing 14 civilians. As Eugene Uwimana reports from Kigali, Ingabire has denied any role in the attack.
Soon after the attack in northern Rwanda that claimed the lives of 14 civilians, Victoire Ingabire condemned the attackers, saying they could not liberate the country by killing civilians. She told VOA that she repeated this before Rwanda Investigation Bureau while pleading her innocence of the accusations. She says, yeah, they interrogated me today and yesterday. I was with my lawyer. They're asking me if I have anything to do with the attack. But I always said FDU party will not have military operations and will not support assailants. The Rwandan government said its forces killed 19 attackers and captured 5 others. Those captured said they belong to FDLR rebel group operating in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which aims to overthrow the Rwandan government. Ingabire says things need to change politically in Rwanda, but without bloodshed. She says, everyone who kills a citizen doesn't love the country. Even those who say are killing in the name of the nation are wrong. You don't have to kill people. Victoire is referring to the deaths of 3 officials of her party who were killed recently in Rwanda by unknown murderers. She accused the government security agents of trying to intimidate her. Rwandan President Paul Kagame has repeatedly warned in speech after speech anyone who would dare to destabilize Rwanda. He says anyone who plans to destabilize our security should think twice. We have normal legal procedures, but for those who don't want it, we have another kind of justice. 50-year-old Victoire Ingabire is the leader of non-registered party FDU Inkingi. She returned to launch their party in 2010 after 16 years of exile in the Netherlands. The authorities jailed her before she could contest the presidential election. She was sentenced for 15 years after being found guilty of many crimes, including minimizing the 1994 genocide against the Tutsi. She was released last year after President Kagame granted her with presidential pardon. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
The people of Kawoman District in Zambia are voting today for new council chairperson. The ruling Patriotic Front Party candidate Ngebe Ngondo will face off with Austin Muneku of the opposition United Party for National Development, UPND. Ahead of today's vote, President Edgar Lungu said Wednesday that about 380 UPND members in Kawoman Chitwa ward have defected to the ruling Patriotic Front. UPND spokesperson Charles Kagoma says the alleged defection is all ruling party propaganda.
The ruling party led by the Republican president of Zambia have been claiming that there are mass defections in the opposition and have been doing that in the past 2-3 years. If one were to compile the statistics, probably the opposition in Zambia members would have all defected to the ruling party. But it is all meant to give an impression that the ruling party is gaining support in the opposition stronghold. But people, obviously, some of them are going there to join the ruling party because they want money, they want with the hunger situation in Zambia, they want food, they want all sorts of things that the government is juggling as a way of enticing people to join them. So it doesn't worry us because those people are just going there, but when it comes to voting, they will not vote for them.
Are you suggesting that the ruling Patriotic Front Party is giving out money to people to defect?
Yes, they are bribing people. They are giving out in this situation, the place where the by-election is taking place has been hit by drought and the hunger. And they are taking maize and millet meal, the staple food, money, and all sorts of materials to try to woo the voters. But apart from bribery, they've also instituted a terror campaign, political violence. In the last few days, they shot dead one of our supporters in Kaoma, and that has angered people there. But the bottom line is that the people are so upset with them because of the hunger situation that is there, the poverty levels, and to top it up, to kill their own children in that area.
Of course, Mr. Kakoma, there is an election in Kaoma District today, Thursday, the election of a new council chairperson in Kaoma. The president has told the people there to vote for the Patriotic Front candidate because this will lead to overall development of the area. What's your prediction for this election?
Well, we are predicting that we are going to win that by-election outright. People have seen the lies that the ruling party and the Republican president is giving them. Secondly, the Republican president is obviously breaking the constitution by threatening not to take development to Kaoma district on the basis of how the people voted. It is an offense under the Zambian constitution to deny people the right to development on the way they voted.
Charles Kakoma is the spokesman for Zambia's main opposition United Party for National Development. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lusaka. This week, women who work in technology and others from across Africa are meeting for their annual Women in Tech Africa Week. They want to bring more women into the tech space industry and combat inequalities in technology use and access, especially for economic empowerment. Stacy Knott reports from the main event in Accra.
Francesca Opoko remembers having to physically send workers to pass on messages or documents when she started her small social enterprise in Ghana 10 years ago. Today, she works to keep up with fast-developing technology to grow her social enterprise that produces natural beauty products. She also trains women she works with in financial literacy, such as using simple mobile technology to manage their money.
Business in the world is going techie, and it's especially relevant for a small business. It's the best way you can make what you're doing known out there.
She was at the launch of the Women in Tech Africa Week in Accra, with other events in six other countries, including Germany, Kenya, and Zimbabwe. Opoko said she wanted to learn more about how she can keep using technology to make her business grow and to ensure she is not left behind in the technology divide. Across Africa, this divide means women are 13% less likely to own a mobile phone and 41% less likely to use mobile internet than men. Ethel Kofi, founder of Women in Tech Africa, an NGO that started in 2015, said addressing this gap was crucial. Her network of 5,000 women across 30 African countries is pushing the conversation about women in technology and leadership.
There is a huge gender gap, And that's part of the conversation, right? So when we are out here showing the world that we actually exist and we're doing things, what it does is it provides avenues for us to support other women. So what, one of the things Women in Tech has done is we've worked with like the Ghana Beauticians Association, the Ghana Traders Association, because even though these women are not necessarily as educated, they still need to be able to use tech to build their businesses.
Kofi says this digital gap between men and women in Africa is a consequence of poverty and economic disparities. Men usually have higher incomes, better access to mobile phones. Kofi and Adam both say more women in tech will mean more problems solved in their own communities. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra.
The World Health Organization says 22 million people in sub-Saharan Africa have distance eye impairment or blindness, and over 20 million have vision impairment in North Africa and the Middle East. The new World Vision Report, issued ahead of World Sight Day today, Thursday, shows that at least 2.2 billion people in the world have vision impairment or blindness. Dr. Stuart Keel is the WHO Technical Officer for Blindness Prevention. He tells Mavis Ocheri that people living in Western and Eastern Sub-Saharan Africa suffer more from blindness.
It's estimated that about 22 million people in sub-Saharan Africa have distance vision impairment or blindness, and the same over 20 million people have vision impairment or blindness in the North Africa and Middle East region.
What could be the attributed cause? Is there a surge in the number of people with vision impairment in Africa?
What the data tells us at the moment is that the proportion of people with blindness in Western and Eastern sub-Saharan Africa is actually about 8 times higher than that in high-income regions. And we also see that about 100 million people with near-vision impairment, that's due to the normal ageing process. And one of the key figures here is that only 80% of people that have near-vision impairment have the appropriate glasses to correct their vision so that they can see well at near. But if we talk about the main drivers for distance vision impairment and blindness, we're looking at conditions such as cataract. Cataract is actually responsible for more than 40% of blindness cases in sub-Saharan Africa. And then we have other conditions such as uncorrected refractive error that can be appropriately addressed with a pair of spectacles, and also glaucoma, which is a condition that in the majority of cases can be prevented, provided that people have access to services and they're detected early and that they can have the appropriate treatment.
Are people in Africa having short and far-sighted glaucoma and cataract able to get the needed care?
Yes, there are shortfalls in that care. We know, as I said before, cataract, there's still millions of people with cataract that need access to surgery. There are still many blindness cases caused by glaucoma and many vision impairment cases caused by short-sightedness and far-sightedness. So one of the key recommendations of the report is to try to address this gap and to try to do that by moving eye care services closer to communities. And so eye care services can be provided at a community level, at a primary care level, so that people have better access to their eye care.
Dr. Stuart Keel is the WHO Technical Officer for Blindness Prevention. He spoke with viewers Mavis Ocheri. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa News. The Zimbabwean government on Wednesday raised the cost of electricity by over 300% amid soaring inflation. This was the second increase in 3 months. The Zimbabwe Energy Regulatory Authority said the price hike is necessary to compensate for the nearly 300% rise in inflation. Frank Guni, chair of the ruling ZANU-PF branch on the east coast of the United States, says Zimbabwe imports electricity from South Africa and Mozambique, and that because of the high cost of importing electricity, the government had no alternative but to raise the cost of electricity. Rwanda's Investigation Bureau Wednesday summoned Victoire Ingabire, leader of the FDU Inkigi political party, for her possible involvement in last week's attack on a tourist center. That's it for this Thursday, October 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford and reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barty in Washington wishing you a very good day.
Want to
relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.